You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome everyone to episode 16 of ADHD BCE. In this episode, we are taking a peek through the ADHD BCE goggles at one of the greatest thinkers of all time, Socrates. Socrates, another ancient Greek, lived in 5th century Athens during a time of immense change and turmoil. Athens was at the time at the height of its power, having built a vast naval empire after the Persian Wars. We can thank Themistocles for that. But if it was also heading towards disaster, because at the time, well, sort of 431 to 404 BCE was the time of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, and this was tearing the Greek world apart. And in the aftermath, the city's democracy had become unstable. And amid all this chaos, a strange, scruffy man was walking the streets, asking uncomfortable questions and challenging the very foundations of Athenian society. And that man was Socrates. He had no wealth, no position of power, and he wrote nothing down. Yet his ideas changed the world. His endless questioning, unfiltered curiosity, and deep moral convictions make him a strikingly familiar character to those of us in the neurodivergent community. But to help us explore whether Socrates may have been one of us, we have, as always, our resident ADHD specialist, Cathy Charlton. Hello, Cathy.
Hello.
Right, Cathy, you're going to love this guy. I don't know how much you know about Socrates, but he's one of my favourite characters from anywhere in the past.
I think it would be difficult not to have heard of him. Yeah, but obviously in different ways, different places. So I'm interested to learn a bit more.
Yeah. Well, let's dive in with that then. So Socrates, he wasn't your typical Athenian citizen. He didn't write books or own property or engage in politics the way the others did. Instead, he spent his days wandering barefoot the Agora, which was their public marketplace, and he would engage anyone who would listen in a lovely big debate. Even during the Peloponnesian Wars, when Athens was under siege and facing starvation, Socrates was still out there asking soldiers and politicians to define justice and virtue. He was so lost in his thought at times that he would stand still for hours, completely absorbed in his own mind. Cathy, I know I've definitely caught myself staring into oblivion when lost in thought. I haven't done it in the middle of a war, but do you think this sounds like ADHD, like hyperfocus, or was he just thinking, was he just living in a thought? What do you think?
It's interesting because you say hyperfocus and, you know, when you said he would stand still for hours, it sounds like he was really stuck till he could kind of work something out. And I wonder if this is kind of part of, you know, again, we're only potentially saying that this is a possible kind of neurodivergent mind, but the fact that, you know, there's a lot we still don't know about the overlap between ADHD and autism, you know, so there's a lot going on in his brain. He's very busy. He's hyper-focusing potentially on whatever it is he's thinking about, but he can't move on. He's stuck till it actually...
Yeah, he's got,
like he's
got to have that resolution, got to know.
Process before he can then kind of move on, which would have been really quite fascinating to watch him suddenly stop in the middle of whatever was going on in a very busy place. You know, stuck on why, you know, trying to get to the bottom of something.
Yeah, I think that's the mind of Socrates. I think, have you heard the Socratic method?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, that's basically... Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. So Socratic method, it was basically relentless questioning.
Yeah. It's drilling down, isn't it? I mean, it's something that sometimes we use that in the counselling world, or from what I can gather, coaches as well, you know, to really kind of drill down to the real purpose of what's going on with the situation, or, you know, why you're being driven a certain way. But also the fact that you said in a note, you know, that we've discussed already, but he would have been very active and moving around within, you know, that, you know, the agora and actually being able to kind of discuss with people. He was kind of also potentially moving through and walking while he was kind of talking and discussing. So, you know, that's often a great aid with an ADHD brain to keep moving. So to have something to fiddle with or fidget, or to kind of, you know, to kind of walk and talk, which is a great useful tool for ADHD brain.
Yeah, I know that the first universities in Athens, the method there was to walk around the gardens. And so you're basically learning as you're mooching around in nature. Mm. In glorious sunshine as well. Not that I'm jealous, but yeah. But if you think about that, he wasn't, what I love about Socrates, he wasn't lecturing people. He wasn't telling you this is how the world is. He was saying, for example, his questions that we know he was asking was, what is justice? What is wisdom? What does it mean to live a good life? And Socrates, he would keep poking at answers until the other person either changed their mind or admitted they didn't really know, which obviously made him a fascinating teacher, but probably incredibly annoying. I know the Athenian leaders especially hated it, as he often exposed the flaws in their reasoning.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, keeping on.
Exactly. Destabilising, isn't it? If you have somebody keep constantly questioning.
Yeah. Well, the way he did do it would be to reduce it down to nothing. You know, there was I can't remember the line now. My first interaction with Socrates was reading Plato's Pythagoras. And so Plato was obviously a student of Socrates, and he was writing down this debate between Socrates and, what was his name? It was Pythagoras, obviously. He was a sophist, wasn't he? A travelling teacher. That was it. So there's like several pages of Socrates just talking to this guy, and he would reduce it down to, we know nothing is essentially what is. I always take this approach to life now. Ever since I read this, it was the only bit of philosophy that stuck with me. I thought, bloody hell, that's absolutely bob on the nose. We can't know anything. We don't know anything. We only know what we've learned or what we interpret. So when it boils down to it, we don't actually know. We can't possibly know anything. And the only way you could be a wise person is to admit that you are ignorant and that you know nothing, and then base your life from that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because one of the lines you just said, which is like, what is wisdom? And actually, it's one of the things we try and kind of seek, you know, we try and kind of look for in the counselling world, especially, you know, have to be kind of wise within your profession, you know.
Right, so the debate's still going then.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But, you know, from my understanding, is the wisest people are the ones that actually keep asking the questions and don't necessarily profess to know it, but maybe will softly challenge and gently kind of think about, well, you know, tell me more about that. And rather than it being a given that, you know, we are the authority, actually we're going to probably annoyingly answer with a question.
I'm going to answer your question with another
very
question.
Very much from what you hear is that's what Socrates was doing. He was never quite leaving it there. He was asking a more. Yeah,
because every answer was insufficient because it was based on trajectory or assumptions or some falsehood. So, yeah. Well, let's talk quickly about his personality then, because he was professed to be socially awkward but magnetic. So, yeah, he had a strange mix of social skills. He was charismatic enough to attract a loyal following of young men, including Plato, who I've already mentioned. But he also had no filter and a habit of publicly humiliating powerful people. Well, we'll come back to that one, because that is definitely something that we suffer with or other people have to suffer as a result of the spectrum. That's quite a common thing there. But yeah, Socrates once told an Athenian general that his definition of courage was nonsense. And whilst they were at war, he told an influential politician he was an idiot, but in a way that forced the man to agree with him. And he was either incredibly brave or completely unaware of the social consequences. And Kathy, I think this to me sounds like such a strongly neurodivergent experience. But we can sort of be the life and soul of the party one moment and completely out of sync the next. How do you see that, Kathy, with Socrates?
Yeah, I mean, it does you know, almost kind of scream ADHD and autism, doesn't it, in a way? But because, you know, one of the things that I come across more anecdotally rather than it being a given way of working out whether someone is ADHD is often not wanting to not have the last word, you know, so always kind of keep going until they've kind of fully completed, but with it on their terms, you know, so quite blind to the fact that sometimes they are really in a very, very precarious position, you know, but also, I suppose, challenging authority, isn't that something we hear quite a lot? You know, one of the things that gets, you know, young kids into trouble who are neurodivergent within the school system or with anything that's kind of,
yeah, absolutely,
they don't disagree, you know, don't agree with, they kind of often fall foul of that. And to be honest, sometimes that Socratic questioning really upsets influential people, you know, whether it be the teacher or the head or whoever's running a particular ruling system, you know, that, yeah, actually, you know, it's undermining, you know.
Well, this is it's very difficult as a neurodivergent. Well, they're not, you know, from my experience anyway, being neurodivergent in the schooling system, it was a nightmare because it was a massively overwhelming situation in the first place, yeah, so you weren't, yeah, relaxed in any way. And then you'd sit in a classroom and they'd be just repeating something out of a textbook. Mm. And as a neurodivergent person, I would be sitting there thinking, oh, who wrote that book? How did, yes, they know? And then what you're talking about, yeah, you've only given me some details of that. Mm. What was the true, yeah, context of that? So it was difficult to keep up with the speed of the lesson because I was trying to process, yep, these other questions. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you asked a question to do with what was going on, it would be deemed irrelevant and disruptive. And you'd be humiliated for it. Yeah. So even on a fundamental level, just on a basic sort of schooling level, that's bad enough. But yeah, I think we've been talking recently in recent episodes, we were looking at neurodivergent fools and jesters and so on in the royal courts of the Renaissance, and how they were privileged neurodivergent people potentially who were given access to the kings because they could take that relentless questioning, the lack of filter. So it can basically, what I'm trying to say there is, you know, there are times and places where, mm, it can be useful. But yeah, I think that this neurodivergent, I don't know, say it's a lack of respect for authority. Mm. It's just, we don't necessarily, we see everybody on the same level. Mm. Everybody is a human being,
yeah,
and it doesn't matter what kind of clothes you're wearing or what title you, yeah, have.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean that you're special. It's just,
I think there's a couple of things goes on from what I experience. Again, this is anecdotal, where there's a real matter of factness, you know, and often it's to try and square off in the brain, like try and make sense of the fact that something doesn't add up here, you know, the patterns haven't aligned. You know, we've talked in the past, haven't we, in episodes about, you know having a real quick grasp of patterns and kind of links, and so when it's not quite squaring up, and often I think a lot of people's experience of sometimes people in power don't necessarily, they might give an answer for why we've got a rule or something's in place, but doesn't necessarily add up, you know, in the bigger picture. And so there's a matter of factness, but also, you know, it's quite visceral when it doesn't add up. It really like hits to the very core, like the bones of a person, you know, where they're really struggling to let it go because it's actually almost so consuming and overwhelming. So I'm going to keep hold of this. It's a bit like a dog with a bone. It's like, I'm not letting go until I can properly kind of lay this to rest and I've got what I need to let it go, you know. It's for the best in the world, it's not going to happen. And it sounds, going back to what we were talking about, how he gets stuck, you know, he's standing still trying to square this off, you know. I wonder if that's partly what's going on as well.
Yeah, to me, that I have autism and ADHD, and that my autism side of the brain is like, yeah, I recognize that. But anyway, we're just going to have a little break and then we'll come back with more Socrates. Yes, right. So Socrates, and let's talk about the demon in his head. And so Socrates often spoke about a mysterious inner voice, his demon, as he called it, that guided him. And he said it. He never told him what to do, only not what to do. Some scholars think this was his conscience, but others have suggested it could have been related to intrusive thoughts or hyperintuition or even auditory processing differences. He described it as an almost physical presence that would stop him in his tracks when he was about to do something wrong. Kathy, could this have been a form of ADHD intuition or even an aspect of neurodivergent sensory processing?
I mean, it's hard to know exactly what was going on for Socrates, because obviously he's describing it, well, somebody's taken these words and they've written it down the best way they can to describe what he was going through. But when I was listening to this, it makes me think of all the different interpretations I've had from various people with a busy brain, you know, and ADHD in particular. And each person's description is slightly different, or there was a couple of similarities, but it is all about how busy things are. And I've heard somebody say, you know, it's like having voices in my head, and then laugh with me because I would be their counsellor, their therapist, and then say, right, but I was always told not to tell anybody, like a doctor, you know, that you've got voices in your head because they're going to cart you off, you know. And actually, it's pretty regular. It's a thing that I've been told is experienced quite a lot. But then, you know, it can be kind of described as being just, you know, a neurodivergent brain is more like the motorway, you know, it's like the M1. It's a lot of traffic going on and lots of, you know, traffic kind of joining and leaving, and it's kind of, and it's relentless, you know, full on. And then somebody who kind of very much interprets the world in an auditory way said it was, we walked into the Tate, so I'm really sorry, but I cannot give credit anywhere. So it was in the Tate Modern, and it was a tower of radios, and they were all tuned in to lots of different stations around the world. No. And they said, oh my God, that's my brain. That's what's happening inside my brain, this Tower of Babel. And it was really helpful for me to witness, you know, what it was that constantly goes in on in their brain. And I'm thinking, no wonder they struggle to stay focused on me when I'm talking and what's going on, because they've got so many other, you know, radios going off in their head. And so I wonder if, you know, it was safer for him to say it was a demon rather than demons, you know. And I wonder what was going on, because to stop him in his tracks, I think that's often something I witness when I'm talking to somebody with ADHD or autism and ADHD, where they literally stop, you know, and they tune out of what we're talking about into something else. It kind of almost takes them away from what's in front of them. And that can be challenging, but also can make for the most interesting exploration. Because, you know, my next question would be, oh, where have you gone? Tell me, you know, what's taking your attention? And often that's maybe really important or very relevant at the time. So
it's all related. I know it is.
Yeah.
But if you think about that pattern seeking behavior as well, that comes into play there. When you're chatting away and somebody's talking, and then you hear something and you, oh, I know what that, but it's like somebody flicks the channel. Your focus is not anywhere near reality. You're off in this thought.
Yeah.
And then whoosh, you can come back out of it again.
Yeah.
And people are looking at you for answers or something. But what you were thinking about then, you need a moment or two to piece it back together sometimes.
And often, you know, it takes other people to fall silent so that process can happen. So sometimes it can come across as almost being inattentive, because, you know, that we described in the past, we have kind of hyperactive and then we have inattentive ADHD, which really looks like someone's kind of caught in the daydream, you know, world.
Yeah.
You're looking out the window, and actually it's them trying to grab hold of you know, and complete a process, because there is, again, it's the M1. There's so much traffic going.
I think that, I know with my brain, it's like an excited dog going to go and fetch the stick. It's like, I'm going to help. I'm going to go and get this. Yeah. And it's only trying, it's not necessarily trying to disrupt or distract. It's trying to be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, again, it's, you know, making sense. I mean, everything we do is making sense, you know. We've got to make sense of, you know, what's in front of us so we can safely put one foot in front of the other, you know. So it's almost kind of part of just living and breathing. But if you've got a lot of information coming at you at all one time, you're not going to put that foot in front of the other till you've really kind of worked it out and it feels safe to do so, you know. Gosh, that really screams to me kind of neurodivergence.
Yeah,
that whole demon in the head. It's a very interesting area.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's have a little continue with Socrates, because he, bless him, he, what a character, what an amazing character. But unfortunately it didn't end too well for Socrates. Well, after the Peloponnesian War, which Athens lost, and thanks to the Persians, wasn't it, funding the Spartans, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, the Athenians lost the war, and at that time, democracy was incredibly fragile. Obviously, before that, Athens was this superpower had risen out of the defeat in fighting off the Persians and setting up the Delian League and all that lot and becoming this superpower. And after losing the war, it was a big shock to them. Not necessarily a shock, but it had a very negative impact. And people were looking for someone to blame. And Socrates, with his constant questioning and disruptive ideas, became an easy target. Yeah. So in 399 BCE, he was put on trial for corrupting the youth and disrespecting the gods. So basically, yeah. Was that another sort of anti-establishment thing going on there? But Socrates being Socrates, rather than begging for mercy, he mocked the jury and suggested he should be rewarded instead of punished. Unsurprisingly, they sentenced him to death. He was then given a chance to escape, but he refused, because to Socrates, sticking to his principles mattered more than life itself. So he calmly drank a cup of poisoned hemlock and spent his final moments talking philosophy with his students. Kathy, this kind of sort of rigid moral code, that also feels very neurodivergent to me. Okay. And like, once we believe in something, that's it. We have to follow through no matter the cost. And I know that feeling in general silly arguments with kids and wives and things like that I've got in my life. I've only got one wife. I don't know why I said it like that. But it's that you get locked. It's like a magnetic switch. You are stuck to your belief. Do you feel like that sort of black and white thinking, or justice sensitivity, is it just neurodivergent people standing by the principles even when it leads to trouble?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is where we still don't really appreciate the relationship between autism and ADHD, because it sounds like the different things you just described often get attributed to either one or the other. And the black and white thinking, and very kind of, you know, it's this way, full stop, you know, and there's no way anyone on this planet can persuade you otherwise. This is how I'm going to be. This, you know, very much kind of can feel quite frustrating to other people, you know, like kind of digging their heels in. And but it's more than just being almost kind of belligerent. I've heard again it described as being like, literally, I'm stuck. I cannot, even though, you know, even if there's other parts of me screaming saying, you know, this maybe it's going to save your neck if you can agree otherwise, it's not coming out of their mouth. It's not happening. And, you know, you can almost kind of have kind of blazing row with the person that, you know, they're still going to kind of stick to that, which is very admirable in some ways. But in other ways, you think, it can be at your own detriment, you know. But it's interesting because it almost goes against what you've said about how he was the master of his own questioning methods, and yet at times would be very black and white about some things. And so that's the dichotomy,
contradiction,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dichotomy, good word.
So, you know, having little room for the grey areas, you know, it's either one or the other, right or wrong, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wonder how much of an internal battle he may have had then with that.
This is know? It. I mean, I always think the Socrates, I wish I knew what his childhood was like, the first 6 or 7 years of his life was like. That would have given us some more information about his possible psyche.
Parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, there we go. So Socrates, what can we say? He was, his relentless questioning changed the world. His method of thinking shaped philosophy, law, and education for thousands of years. His ability to hyper-focus on ideas and challenge authority made him both a genius and a target. His unique social style, he was charismatic yet socially offbeat, and his commitment to his principles, even to the point of death, shows the strength of potential neurodivergent conviction. Socrates lived in a world that was undergoing massive political and cultural upheaval, and instead of going along with it, he questioned everything, and this made him dangerous to the establishment, but invaluable to history. So was Socrates neurodivergent? Well, of course, we're never going to know for sure. But his life shows so many hallmarks of ADHD and autism, that relentless questioning, passionate mind, and refusing to accept anything at face value. And that's the beauty of neurodivergence. It's not just about seeing the world differently. It's about shaping the world in ways that no one else could have imagined. Although Socrates may have been a gadfly, as his critics called him, but history has proven that sometimes the people who challenge a system are... Well, they are are the ones who push humanity forward. So here's to Socrates. Kathy, on a scale of 1 to neurodivergent, from what you've learned about Socrates, where are you putting him?
I think he's definitely up there. What a great choice to discuss. I think what I love the most about him was he was potentially authentic. He didn't really have an agenda. He was much his own man.
Yeah, well spotted. I love that about him as well, Kathy. There was a wonderful story about, I can't remember the name of this guy, but there was a beautiful boy in his teens, in his absolute prime, and Socrates was just, this is the magnetic side of Socrates, this young man was trying desperately to seduce Socrates, but no matter what he did, this boy was complaining that Socrates just didn't get the hints. He didn't pick up on the social cues. You know, he was, I think he was, Socrates was just out and out. For me, I feel like as someone with autism and ADHD, I feel very strong autism with him.
Yeah.
That's what's resonating with me anyway.
Yeah. Although, you know, a strong autism, but then you're saying bad gadfly, which I had to ask you what that meant. And I think that now we talk about it being flitting and not quite being able to stay on point all the time. Again, you know, there's the strong ADHD pull as well going on.
Well, I for one would absolutely welcome Socrates into the halls of neurodivergence. He's been a hugely influential guy. And to be honest with you, we need more Socrates. We need more of them.
Yes.
Well, thank you very, very much, Kathy. That was it was wonderful to discuss Socrates with you. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And yeah, we'll see you again soon.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.